Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Bob's Red Mill believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And, you know, you've heard me talk many times on this show that learning about food history has often been not an easy thing for some people. You have to kind of find your way into it through the back door sometimes. And for years, food history remained the purview of a few researchers writing papers and academic journals. But over the past couple of decades, interest has really grown in knowing what we ate in times past and where certain foods and different cuisines came from. And with that growing interest has come writers, popular books, teachers, interest groups, even courses in colleges, and soon, hopefully, a magazine to address the popular interest in food history. So today I thought I would address what some of those sources are, and some of the people behind what helps us learn about food history. Emmeline Rood, who is the person responsible for creating, hopefully a magazine. It's on a Kickstarter page right now and looking for support. Emmeline is a historian and a writer, and she was a guest on this show with her book, Tastes Like Chicken. And she joins me from D.C. to talk about this startup magazine. We'll hear all about it. And then I also have in the studio Ken Albala. And Ken is a professor of history, and we'll learn more about his background. And he's devoted a good part of his career to writing about and teaching students about food and culinary history. So let's get Emmeline on the line and talk about her new project. Emmeline, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome. You know, this magazine, Repast, is called, has spiked a lot of interest, I think, from a lot of different people. Tell us a little bit about what your thoughts are for this magazine, what you're trying to do.
So this idea kind of came to me out of the blue. As you said, I'm a food historian. I write a lot of articles for magazines. I wrote that book. And I don't know if other food historians experience this, but I'd always had trouble finding that right fit. I'm not an academic, and so a lot of the stuff that I write and I produce and I like to read isn't really necessarily in an academic journals. But at the same time, when trying to write for a magazine like Bon Appetit or Savour, there's not really as much of a space for these kind of stories. So I thought, well, why don't we just create our own? Why don't we create an outlet that shares these wonderful, crazy, fantastic recipes, stories, people who've cooked and eaten things for centuries in one place for the popular medium? So that's kind of where this whole idea came from.
Well, and who do you envision as your audience? Who are you really targeting with this magazine?
We want it to be general interest. I mean, you don't, as we're hitting the point home, you don't have to be a food historian, a scholar, to get into what we are trying to present. You just have to want to know where your food comes from. You just want to be interested in your food. So we aim to be a popular magazine for all readers and all eaters, as it were.
And I think certainly there is a growing interest in that. And you even notice in some of the, you know, the glossies that have been around for quite some time, like Sever. Sever has really gotten into more travelogue and background and history of a lot of the foods that they write about. Yeah. So I think that to state it from the, you know, the outset that it is a popular magazine of food history, I think that that really has something going for it. Now, in order to do this, I know because I did talk to you in the planning stages, and it's full disclosure. And I am a big supporter. But you were looking for some people who could write some articles for an early issue, a sample issue or a first issue. And one of them happens to be sitting in the studio with me right now, and that's Ken Albala. So tell me a little bit about some of these articles for what would be a first issue.
So the theme of the first issue is the food of the gods, which I just thought was such a wonderful, you could get so many rich and fascinating stories from that. And so obviously Ken, he has a great article, it's called What Did Jesus Eat? and it's basically exploring sort of what are the Judeo-Christian diet back when Jesus was alive. There's not really much evidence in the Bible of what he ate, so he's sort of exploring this idea. He can obviously go into more depth because he is the expert. We also have another great article. I had no idea that this was even a thing, on the ancient tradition of Tibetan butter carving by pastry chef turned butter historian Elaine Kosrova. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yes, you are.
It's just basically the story of this rite, this ritual, and how it came to be in that corner of the world. A more recent one that I'm very excited about is soul food scholar Adrian Miller has an essay he has just given me on the gospel bird, which is sort of race, religion, fried chicken in the American South, which is delicious and awesome.
So the articles are as much as they are historical articles, they're also very topical.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. All right, so now we get into the nitty-gritty, and that's the Kickstarter program. I mean, that's pretty brave of you to, you know, put this out there. And
it is a little terrifying, to be honest. But the amount of support I've gotten far exceeded my anticipation. I posted it on a food group that I'm a member of, and it just sort of... And I made the mistake, not the mistake, I made the wonderful mistake of putting my email out there, and my inbox is just full of people who are so excited, they have ideas, they'd like to help out. So I think the idea really resonates with people in a way that even I didn't anticipate, somebody who loves this subject. So,
well, that's terrific. So how long is the Kickstarter going to be active?
We have 20 more days exactly. It ends on May 11th at 9:10 a.m. because I started it on April 11th at 9:10 a.m. So yeah, 20 more days of just trying to get the word out, seeing who else is excited about food history in this way.
So. Well, that's wonderful. Well, so let's turn to Ken. Now, Ken is no stranger to this program, although it's always been by phone out on the West Coast, because Ken is a professor of history at the University of the Pacific and director of the food, well, was director, he founded the food studies program in the master's program in San Francisco. Ken has authored or edited 24 books and counting, or more. Now, is it 25 now? Or
about to be 25.
to be 25 on food, including Eating Right in the Renaissance, Food in Early Modern Europe, Cooking in Europe, the 13th through the 17th centuries, okay, The Banquet, which I think is wonderful. Beans, which is a recent one. I'm not going to list them all because they are many, 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 many. But... Ken, you're also editor of the series, The Studies in Food and Gastronomy, and you also have a cultural culinary history course, one of the great courses.
That's right, yeah.
On cultural culinary history, available on DVD from the Great Courses program.
And if you're on Audible, it's free, basically.
Wow, terrific. 36 episodes. I mean, how easy is that? You just put it in there and you learn about it, you know, that's great. So you really are have this firsthand knowledge of what people want and teaching them and how they perceive a lot of these things. And I credited you, we were talking before the show, I kind of credited you with being one of the, not if not first, early people who made culinary food history approachable to the common man. I mean, you didn't have to be sitting in your ivory tower somewhere, you know, and be, you know, in a holy scholarly or academic pursuit. I mean, that you wrote books that were scholarly. They certainly were not, you know, not.
Yeah,
but
I think
they were approachable.
There have been people writing about food history for a long time. If you think of Kurlansky and Betty Fussell and John McPhee's book on oranges, I mean, there's, and even Zuckerman, the one about potatoes, the one from the 40s, Redford Salomon.
Yes.
I mean, so there have been popular food histories around a lot. I don't think it was really legitimate among scholars as an academic concentration. Even when I started, it wasn't. That was, you know, 25 years ago or so. It is now. Mm-hmm. Like now, it's totally legitimate. You know, you won't get giggles when you talk to your advisor and say, I want to write about food. But I'm probably the first generation that really did focus on food alone as an academic. And I think, you know, for the number of people who write about food and have academic jobs, I would say the majority of them really aren't interested in the popular side still. You know, they're a handful.
Well, I mean, there is, it is still, there's so much to uncover as far as foodways and the relationship with, you know, migrations and populations.
That's right. And it's writing for a different audience. You know, when you're generating the information from primary source documents and old cookbooks and things, you are writing for academic journals largely and for university presses, and that's to get tenure. That's the way, you know, a scholarly profession works. And I think the people who write for certainly the trade press usually are not those same people. Usually they're journalists.
Right. Right. Yeah, I find that a lot when I'll see a great article. I say, oh, I would like to pursue this more, possibly as a topic for a show. But the only source that I could find from that is the journalist himself and that or herself. And that was a one-off kind of thing, you know.
That's right. And I think that the people writing popular food history are getting much better. You know, there's not a lot of sloppy work out there now, which is good.
So tell me, what was your reaction to Emmeline's idea of Repast?
Well, I think she just asked me, and without thinking, I said, yeah, sure, that sounds like fun. I think it's a wonderful idea, because I've had the same experiences that she's had, in that I would have loved to pitch a story to Savour or to Bon Appetit or anywhere, you know, where they do food stories, and I could have focused on the recipes themselves and just said, look, here's a great unexplored cuisine, 500 years old, no one knows it. You know, this is the new unexplored you know, exciting thing, and they have no interest whatsoever. Mm. So I think this will create a really interesting niche. For serious work, I think the lineup of writers she has for the first issue is great. And if it can get into paper and get distributed well, that would be wonderful.
And so, Emmeline, we were talking also about it before the show, and the Kickstarter program. We give all our support behind that, and we think that's wonderful. But don't give up. There's always the internet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, Ken, you have been involved in so many different facets of food history. And most recently, I mean, I know we are Facebook friends, and I noticed that, you know, every time your feed would pop up, your pictures would pop up on my feed, I'd see noodles all over the place. And you're always colorful noodles, different, you know, exotic noodles and plain noodles. So I figured, knowing Ken, something's up with noodles, right?
So this has been the obsession for the past, I would say, almost 3 years. Happened totally by accident. I didn't plan it. I thought this could be a trade press cookbook. Turns out the trade, I don't know whether it was bad agents or whatever, the trade didn't want it. And that's partly because I don't really like writing in standard recipe format. Mm-hmm. I prefer just to teach you a technique and then say, go, do it the way you like it and use use this amount of parsley. And I think the modern recipe format can really be constricting and doesn't really serve well to educate people.
Right.
So the cookbooks that I have done that were trade press, The Lost Art of Real Cooking and its follow-up were not what really looked like old recipes. You know, they weren't. They were modern recipes, but they weren't in that standard format. Here's the list of ingredients. Here's the list of procedures written for people who know nothing about the kitchen. These were written for, you know, people who wanted to have fun and do something difficult and dangerous. So this noodle soup project is part history, part philosophy, partly the, you know, the whole world of noodle soup, not just you know, Italian and Asian, but German and South American. And so I've tried to cover the whole world. A lot of it is, it's mostly techniques for people who think, I really want to know how to make noodles, but don't really want to buy a machine or don't, you know, you don't need a machine. And I would say maybe a third of it are things I just invented. I had so much fun doing it that I ended up creating things that don't exist on Earth.
The pictures certainly were a testament to
that. And that was another weird thing. I never expected in a million years to become a photographer. So that was fun. And the University of Illinois Press picked it up, which is great. I mean, I've worked with them before. And they gave me 80 color illustrations, which was unheard of for an academic press. And I think they see this as a kind of crossover into popular titles.
Yeah. Well, you know, writing about noodles specifically, and then you did a couple other books for some of the little series
the edible series.
The edible series,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But the other thing that the last time I think that we spoke on the show was about your handbook of food studies, like what to read like a primer for, you know, food studies.
Yeah, it's meant for introductory level food studies courses. Routledge just asked me to do a second edition, so I'm very happy about that. And I think the majority of contributors said, they'd update their bibliographies and rewrite a little. And so that should come out, I think, 2018.
You know, because so often a lot of the comments I'll get from my listeners would be, well, you mentioned some book on your show. What was it? Or do you have any recommendations? I want to learn more about food history. Do you have any recommendations of what to read? And often I will just tell them to take a look at your book, because you really start at the very early beginning with some of the texts, the early texts from some of our earliest sources.
Well, you're probably thinking of the reader right now.
I'm talking about the reader, yeah.
History reader,
right.
Which is just primary texts. And it's paperback, so it's affordable. And that's Bloomsbury who did that. Mm. And Bloomsbury has been really, it's a very big publisher in Britain. They've been very good to me. They just came out with a 10th anniversary edition of my Beans book in paperback, retypeset it and everything. So I thought, like, wow, that's nice of you. Why not?
Yeah. Hey, when something's good, don't throw it away. You know. Well, Emmeline, I'm sure you probably have a couple of questions to ask Ken as well. So we're going to take a little break, and as soon as we come back, we'll kind of get both of you in on the conversation here. Okay.
Great.
Stay tuned.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife Charlie started Bob's Red Mill almost 4 decades ago. Today they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his 4 children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
We are back, and we're talking about food history, the approachable food history, and a new magazine that's in the works called Repast with Emmeline Rood. And she has a Kickstarter page that you can visit, and if you're interested, you can read all about it there. And Emmeline, why don't you, is there an address you have for the Kickstarter page?
Oh, yeah. If you just Google Repast on Kickstarter, you'll find it.
Okay.
But if you also, if you have any questions, the email is repastmag@gmail.com.
All right, repastmag@gmail.com. Well, I think that Ken may have the workings of possibly another article coming up soon. Ken, you said you're in the process of researching a new book. Can you talk about your new project?
Yeah, I can. It's rather strange. This is something I've been kicking around with for more than 20 years. And actually, Alan Davidson is the one who originally encouraged me to write about this. And he said, you know, there's really nothing good written about aphrodisiacs. And I knew a bit about it from the sort of humoral medicine in the Renaissance side of everything. And Michael Lehman, who owns Reaction Books, you know, with a little edible series, has been pestering me for the past several years. You need to write about aphrodisiacs. You need to do this. And I was prepared to take this sabbatical, which is this semester, and write about fasting. It's something I've been researching for about a decade. Which is really, really slow for me. And I went on a writing retreat, looked at all my notes that I've taken over the years, and I'm just not that interested in the topic anymore. So I said, you know what? I don't owe the world anything with this. I've gotten articles out of it, and I've got other things, and including the thing that I wrote for Repast, actually, is based on that research. And I thought, let me just change courses completely and start something fresh, and thought aphrodisiacs would be fun. And so I got the contract, and what's sort of weird is, as a food writer, you can't really read about food and think about it because you'll get hungry, right? Mm-hmm. You can't think about, oh, maybe I'll cook this. Maybe I'll do something with this. You know, you just turn on a different part of your brain and think, oh, this is research. I'm getting this information, transferring it. And I've been successful doing that my entire career. I can read about food and take notes and not get hungry. Aphrodisiacs, I have been an utter failure thus far. Again, I'm in my office by myself reading about how to get horny, and it's just like, it's been really distracting so far.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic to pursue. So what do you have any anticipated dates on when you might have a book on that?
Oh, gosh, it's due.
What are we talking?
Yeah, it's due in the fall 2018, so I would say probably a year after that.
That's not bad.
A couple years out. Yeah. And I haven't really written anything yet. I'm just doing research. Mm-hmm. And it is true that most of the books out there are terrible. I mean, there are, you know, popular cutesy cookbooks and things.
Yeah.
But the serious research on the topic, the last book was written in the 50s, I think, or early 60s, and before that in the mid-19th century. So there's really almost no serious scholarship about it. And what I have found is that everyone makes this assumption that a food will be aphrodisiac because of its shape, that it somehow looks like a phallus or something. And that is completely untrue. There's nothing in the past literature about that at all. And I think no one has really just looked at it very closely, you know, to see what was the logic of why they were recommending certain things and not things. And the whole other side of the coin, which is equally fascinating to me, is why people would say avoid these certain foods if you want to stay chaste. If you're a monk or you're trying to, you know, or you're unmarried. And the things... There's a definite logic to it. Avoiding spices, for example, they thought that would be stimulating, would heat your body and stimulate your libido. So surprisingly, a lot of the very rich information comes from the fasting literature. Oddly enough.
So there you tied the two together.
Yeah, I did. That's exactly it.
Holy feasts and holy fasts.
That was
Carolyn
Bynum. Yeah. She was one of my advisors in college.
Yeah,
that was, Columbia.
That was an excellent book.
Yeah.
So Emmeline, you can possibly look forward to an article on aphrodisiacs. That would be a
fun.
Good cover.
That'd be great.
How often do you foresee this magazine being published? Let's say everything goes well. How often would you see this coming out?
In a dream world, it would be a quarterly.
Mm-hmm.
First, mainly because I want it to be regular. I want people to, but also history takes time. You can't expect a historian to crank out a legitimate article every month. So I felt a quarterly was sort of a nice.
You could, quarterly.
Ken saying, sure,
quarterly is not not overly ambitious at all. And I think, you know, I used to edit the Food Culture and Society, co-edit it, and I think if you make a sort of easy way to put in submissions, there are enough food historians out there that you can get, you know, a handful of articles quarterly very easily.
Yeah, even the one post, the number of people who had ideas and background, it was incredible.
Yeah.
I think everyone is a closeted food historian.
Yeah. Or, you know, they say foodie in some circles, you know, for liking food and wanting to know about food. But food historians, they haven't quite gotten their handle yet. We got to give a handle to them.
We need a hashtag.
Right. There you go. Well, I think the what I have seen so far, and everyone can see it if they go to, to the Kickstarter page, it's beautiful to look at as well. I mean, you do nice work with photographs and
yeah, we have a designer who's incredible. She's really good. So, and that was the other thing. So many illustrators have already sent me ideas and stuff. It'll be engaging. It'll be beautiful.
Well,
I'm excited.
That must be so encouraging to you to come up with this idea and have such a positive response.
Yeah, it's great. It's incredible. I'm a little, when I'm not terrified refreshing the Kickstarter page, I'm overwhelmed by how excited people are.
Funny. So do you plan to get, like, big advertisers and put in ads in the space?
No, ideally not. Ideally, it would be self-funded through just sales, and I've talked to quite a few of the smaller magazines, because we're not going to go out of the bat, have a million subscribers, be the next Bon Appetit, because... for many reasons, obviously. But if you say small, there's no need to do advertising if it's run right. And that, I think, is ideal. So that's the plan.
Don't litter the pages with...
Right. Well,
yeah,
it's annoying.
I just don't think it's necessary. I don't think it fits with what we're trying to do. We don't want to advertise. I don't know. No.
Yeah, well, I mean, the trend in most food magazines now is the ads look like articles, so you don't know what's the content
too.
and the even the articles themselves look like ads, so it's it's annoying.
That's the latest thing, the hidden, I can't remember what the term is, but the sponsored content.
Right, exactly right.
It's caught me, I'll be halfway through something, oh, wait a minute, this is...
Yeah.
Well, not that it's not good.
14th century chef sponsored content.
That's right.
That'll be great. Well, you need a big sugar daddy, I guess. That's what you need. Carry it along. But I think certainly if, people, and I think it's a kind of a nice launching pad for a lot of people who might not know that they're interested in food history and will read these articles, and that will be something that could inspire them to then fly out to California and enroll in the food studies course. No, but that is something interesting, too, that there are so many food studies courses now at a lot
crazy.
Of universities that you could never find it before.
Well, it's I think the popularity in academia has followed the popular press, and followed the magazine, not magazine so much, but I think if you look at the books that are out there now that are about food history, and just interest in it in general, academia is following it. It's not leading. There is, in fact, a new journal. It's Global Food History, which is published, I can't remember now, but Jeff Pilcher is editing it, and I think it's in its first year.
So that has a different slant.
Yeah, it's peer reviewed. Kind of academic journal, but that I think is just evidence that the whole, rising tide lifts all boats, as we say.
So.
That's right. Well, I can't say enough how interested I am in the whole notion of this magazine, and I wish you all kinds of luck, because I think it's a worthwhile project. And again, it's called Repast, R-E-P-A-S-T, Repast, and. That can be found on, you can just Google that and find the page on that. while you're kind of floating around looking for heritageradionetwork.org, because we have a nice little beating heart button, and we are a member-supported radio network. So it's all these member-supported things are very important, because people who enjoy listening and enjoy reading, you know, they have to pay up, don't you think? Just like buying books. You don't buy a book, but, you know, you can listen to the radio for free or read a magazine online for free. It's nice to be able to give back. Ken, anything else you would like to let us know that you're interested in here?
Gosh, I could talk about anything pretty much. I would love to give the food studies program a plug, as long as you mentioned it.
We're plugging everything today.
We're in San Francisco, so we're really the only Master of Arts degree in food studies on the West Coast. I think our program probably looks something like NYU's, in that it's based in social sciences. You know, it's anthropology, sociology, history, literature, business. So it's maybe a little different in that NYU's is more toward public health because it's in a school
and
of education.
Health and nutrition.
Totally an independent unit, nowhere near, you know, the administration back in Stockton. But we're graduating our first class in May, so that will be very exciting.
Okay.
You know, it's a 2-year program, and we have a handful of students who've gone through from the beginning, which is very exciting. If you're in San Francisco, we also have what are called Saturday seminars. So every couple of weeks, we'll have an important person come in and give a talk, and they're free. You just come in, and beautiful new campus, which is in the bottom of the new dental school building in San Francisco, right on 5th and Minna, which is by the Powell Street station. So it's right smack, you know, below Market Street, in the middle of within walking distance of like the Ferry Plaza and things like that. So for food people, it's a great location. And I'm excited. You know, I'm not involved in the administration of it anymore, which is really nice. But I'll be teaching the food history class starting in the fall.
Wonderful.
I'm excited.
That's excellent. Yeah. Well, as long as we're plugging things too, I wanted to announce that the Culinary Historians of New York has just opened up the applications for their new season of scholarships. And this is for people who don't have to be students. They can be established writers, researchers, someone who's working on a project of culinary or food history. You can find out all the information on the website. It's culinaryhistoriansny.org. And there are 3 grants given. And we encourage people to take a look. And if they've got something of interest they're working on, you know, give it a try. Worst we can do is say no, try next year.
That's great. Well, you know, there's sources of funding that are popping up all over the place now. The Oxford Symposium now has student grants that support students to come. I just happen to be the person that those emails came to, so I've been involved in processing it. But there's a lot of culinary historians around the country. There's maybe about 6 or 7 different groups. The Culinary Historians of Northern California, there's the Southern California, which has been around for a long time.
We tried to tie them all
Boston.
Together one time, and
yes,
it didn't work.
I remember that. Well, you know, it was, what was the woman's name who tried to do it? She gave it some very interesting...
From Chew or something.
Nacho or something.
Nacho. It was Nacho. You're right. Yeah, that's what it was.
It was Sandy Oliver tried to put the whole thing together. And I think she had a listing of food museums and... that was a great idea.
Well, the groups keep in touch, and we kind of share the programs that we've had, and we keep each other's emails, you know, going back and forth. But it's great that there are there's so much popular interest in food history and culinary history with groups like this and books and hopefully this magazine. And definitely the food studies course. I think that's wonderful. And I know that many of the people who listen to this program are those kind of people out there.
So. Yeah. Well, I think the best part about this program in California is eventually we will be online. So you can take a degree from anywhere, you know, and... I think it'll be great.
Take the entire degree online,
every single course. There's a lot of strange legal issues about operating out of state, and you know, you need a license to in California would be okay, and actually out of the country is no problem. But like, if we want to have students in Sheboygan, then we need a special license in that state.
So because that's for a degree program. I mean, that's different. Also, there are some online programs that exist, but
that's right. But you know what I think happened is that the places like University of Phoenix and all these online companies were making tons of money and stealing revenue and students, obviously, from each state. And the state said, oh, well, we're going to charge you as long as you're making money off of us and taking our students. And that was the target. It hit other schools that were, you know, Pacific is a relatively small university. So I don't, I know some states have agreements that they can take students from other places. We don't. California doesn't yet. So this is all pending legislation, apparently. Yeah.
So if it's not online yet, then fly out to California.
That's right.
Right. Right. Well, Emmeline, anything else you want to say about repast before we wrap things up here?
If you like food history, then I think you'll like what we're trying to do. So.
Nice tagline. I like that.
And please check it out.
Indeed. Check it out. All right. Well, thank you both for being involved in approachable food history, bringing it to popular interest. I think we're going to see a real growth in food history and exciting things to come. And well, look what happened. This whole radio network popped up around food. So, you know, go figure. You know, there are people who are finally realizing that, well, food is important. We might as well talk about it and read about it and learn about it.
That's right. Historians, too. You know, I mean, it's politics is important, and so is war, and so are, you know, there's always big issues, but everyone eats.
You gotta eat, right.
It's the job that most human beings have had on Earth forever, is growing food and preparing it. And, you know, if you want to understand what really makes people tick, you have to understand why they eat what they do and why they avoid what they do. And, you know, I think it's a great approach to history in general, is going
Excellent.
Through food.
It's a great way to learn about people, as you, mm-hmm. you learn about what they ate. All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining me. And Ken, so glad I got to snag you to come in the studio on your sabbatical here visiting New York. And Emmeline, again, I wish you all the luck in the world with this magazine.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in. And don't forget to visit our homepage, heritageradionetwork.org. Okay, and join us again next week on A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.